Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. Congratulations for surviving the registration line. They should give you a physical badge for that. My name is Jeff Roars. I'm Vice President of Marketing Research and Education for ExactTarget. And it is my great pleasure today to moderate and instigate and stir the pot for what we should have as a great panel. I'd like to begin by having the panel just introduce themselves. Then we'll talk about format, and then we'll kick things off. So Scott, Urban Airship.
Hi, everybody. My name is Scott Covina. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Urban Airship. We provide a platform for app developers to help drive engagement. We do that with things like push notifications, in-app purchase, subscriptions. We've got about 40,000 customers.
You got to get right on that microphone.
I'm right on the microphone. There we go. Sorry. Scott Covina, Urban Airship. Most everybody heard it. But I also am going to do what is probably going to be suicide. I'm going to try and play a video right now. It's a really short one, but we'll see if we can make it work.
So we're going to be talking a little bit about push as part of the conversation, but let's have Matt and Chris introduce themselves, and then we'll circle back around. Matt?
Thanks. I'm Matt Galligan. I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called Circa, which has not launched yet. So we're just at Circa on Twitter, or CIR.ca. We're a news startup, but previous to that, I started a company called Simple Geo. So I have a little bit of an idea about what we might talk about here. And Simple Geo is now in the hands of Urban Airship, to my right. And I don't have a pretty video to show you, so I'll just try to look nice up here.
Chris.
Hi. Hello. Test. Good. Yeah. Okay. My name is Chris Messina. I work at Google. It's a small startup in Mountain View. Before January, I was in developer relations, and so I worked on platforms. And as of January, I switched over to be a UX designer on Google Plus. So I'm sort of balancing both or whatever. Previously, I worked for myself at a small consulting company called Citizen Agency, and I helped co-found Barcamp and Coworking, and I have the...
And the hashtag.
Yeah, perhaps the dubious.
The inventor of the hashtag.
That happened.
It did.
And Chris would like to clarify, those are not Google goggles. Do not ask them about them. He doesn't have any information on any of you as he looks your way.
I know nothing
questions.
About anything.
All right, so folks in the back, you are our enforcers. If you have any problems hearing us, please speak up. We're going to take the first 30 minutes here and have a conversation a little bit amongst ourselves. We'll then open it up for questions. I think we are going to actually move the microphone maybe into the room a little. That's a little too local at this moment.
No, I think I like this, actually.
Do you like that? We're
going to
do that?
Right,
okay,
there.
That's fine with me. I'm just here to serve.
No, sure.
So, you know, our title today is about social, local, and mobile redefined. But before we can do that, we have to set the playing field as to what this moment in social, local, and mobile is. So perhaps each of you can give your thoughts on, you know, what are the parameters of social, local, and mobile today?
Well, I guess I'll start because I'm closest. But I think the big thing right now is this, you know, we finally have these devices, these real computing devices. The last 20 years of computing has just been, you know, sort of people sitting in front of computers and then going away. And now we have this computer that knows who we are, knows where we are, knows who our friends are, and knows how we behave. And I think that's going to have a significant impact. It already is and will over the next 10 to 20 years on more businesses, more industries than we've ever seen before.
Yeah, I'll just kind of continue down that path. I think that this, to me, is my extension of my personality and identity. This is my second brain. It tells me where I need to be, when I need to be. I take pictures with it, so it's recording the things that I see. I think that all of the apps that I tend to interact with will have some level of social, local, or mobile, or combination thereof, taking part, because that's just kind of... The technology itself allows me to tap into this second brain now. So you'll have some combination, like either all of the three things, social, local, and mobile, which I think most of the apps that I see are, or they will have some explicit reason why they're not including one of those three, like Square, which has local and mobile, but doesn't necessarily have social because it's a payment processor. But I do think that you'll see almost any app have some semblance of all three of these things in and a part of it.
Yeah, so I mean, I think to take a slightly countervailing perspective on this, I think right now we're actually in sort of a huge period of confusion over, you know, what the mobile device should be for, how it should be used, because we're coming out of an era of technology that was defined largely by file types. And so you had your movies and you had your photos, you had your documents and things like that. And people are sort of only being layered into the experience now. And the idea of like a personal computer is also such that it presumes that everybody has their own personal device that they're logged into to multiple different networks. And what hasn't happened, and perhaps what the next generation of computing will be, not this year and probably not next year, because we're still so early in this, is thinking about what group or ad hoc computing will be like. When devices are so cheap that you can basically go someplace and they're just handed out for free, as Chromebooks are on airplanes sometimes. And then when you're done with it, you sort of like dispose of it. So I think when we think about these things, some of the unmet or sort of unsolved problems revolve around how you bring personalization that you've sort of stored on one of the clouds to some other device that is connected to the cloud, and then you get rid of the device when you're done with it. Now, I, of course, love my device and devices, so that feels really weird for me to say, but I think a lot of people don't necessarily want to have devices with them at all times. And so figuring out that balance between those of us who do and are willing to basically broadcast everything that we do to the entire planet versus those who don't is a major challenge that will need to be resolved, you know, now and into the future.
So let's dig in on that a bit further. Do you feel that kind of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt of consumers around how their data is being pulled together is one of the big shaping factors in this space looking ahead?
Go ahead. I hate to be the person to say it because Matt will probably say it or Chris will say it, but I think the concept of privacy is going to go away over time. Whether we like it or not. I mean, it's just happening anyways because of the inherent nature of these devices and the way that we're sort of slowly sharing. You know, before this panel, before we got up here, we were talking backstage, and, you know, 10 years ago, they were holding congressional hearings about cookies on devices, right? The idea that a bunch of senators are sitting there and grilling internet companies about why are you putting these cookies on these computers? And now, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I just have cookies turned on. And this device, especially the iPhone, it's sort of like you either turn them on or you don't. And I think that we're going to see the same thing happen with a whole bunch of other types of uses of this device over time.
You know, it's an interesting point, I guess. When you think about, like, the touch computing, it's a much more personal, much more sort of intimate way of actually dealing with computers, as opposed to sort of having this disembodied appendage through the mouse or the keyboard and a screen that kind of like speaks back to you. Once you internalize that idea that you should be able to touch a computer and have it respond to you as though it knows you, as though a person, you know, when you shake their hands, they're knowing something about you, changes, I think, that, I don't know, that relationship. And I don't know to what degree it changes it, but I know, like, you know, Scott's kids, for example, when they pick up an iPad, they intuitively know how to just sort of like smear things around and make things happen, and they press buttons and stuff happens, and it just kind of works. And right now, of course, that experience is not personalized. And so in the future, you can imagine picking up a device, it having some notion of who you are, being able to look up something about you, change the way that the interface responds to you, whether you're colorblind or whether you need assistive technology or whether you just, you know, don't want to see any meat because you're a vegetarian on the menu, for example. That is going to become the expectation. And so the balance between that convenience that's afforded to people who are willing to express more about themselves either in the open or through channels that they control I think is going to be very interesting to see develop. And so there's a constant question. I think if anybody's used, I don't know if it was Windows 8 or something, I missed that experience, but apparently there was a lot of pop-ups always asking you for permission. You can imagine that might be the experience that some people usher into the world because they think that you should be explicitly asked every time there's a moment of personalization. On the other hand, if computers are able to know things more ambiently about the user and be able to respond in kind and provide a better experience, an elevated experience, something that gets the computing out of the way and gets the task in the sort of user's vantage point, I think that's going to actually win ultimately.
I think that one of the biggest challenges is just ignorance. You've got one senator now trying to pass a bill that has something to do with, oh, all of these phones now and developers can have access to my photos. That's super scary and I don't want that, and I'm going to try to pass a bill that makes it required so that I pop up something that says, do you give access to your photos?
I mean, it's like learning that your computer has access to your files. Like, you know, yeah.
It's a messaging problem, though. That's I think, the biggest challenge here, because right now the pace of technology is quickly outstripping our ability to create laws around it. And I think that what you're seeing now is like the Path debacle, where all of a sudden we had knowledge that Path and many other apps had access to our address book in a non-approved way, or it just kind of happened in the background. And now you have people trying to pass legislation to get around or to prevent that. And I think that for us to be able to continue to innovate at this pace, there's going to be some little bit of messaging that we have to make sure that we put in the underlying message so that something doesn't get misconstrued.
I mean, the bummer about that, too, about the Path thing, is that it actually made the app really nice, right? I mean, it did, right?
The purpose of the app.
It was the whole purpose of it.
You're
same
telling
thing with Twitter,
me that a social...
with Instagram and all these things, and now if it's going to have to ask me or throw up some dialogue where every time it wants to do something, that's going to make it horrible.
Well, so I think there's a little bit of a difference here, and I think we have to be very careful. And I think people who are building apps and you know, developers who have new startups, one of the things that's really important about a lot of these things is the degree to which you're willing to embarrass yourself or your friends by using an application. And if an application actually embarrasses you unknowingly, or you find out later, you know, it's like having like your fly down for like a week and like no one told you. Like, that sucks. You're just not going to use that app. And so from a brand perspective, if you are building these apps, I think it's actually like important to think about that and to think about what it means to sort of make a promise to someone to say, look, I'm not going to embarrass you. I'm going to give you a good experience. There'll be moments where if you do something and it's unexpected, you may end up being embarrassed. But look, I think you're possibly an enlightened person, or I'm going to give you the opportunity to say no. And then it's up to you if you want this thing to work the way it should work or not. Though I think we are in the very, very early days, and I think a lot of people's expectations have somewhat, I think to your point, like been naive about the way these apps sort of magically know who your friends are without you needing to divulge anything about yourself.
But to use your example specifically, sometimes we forget, and I think that just human nature to forget that something has turned on. I had this happen to me the other day. I turned on, it's like sharing between Fab and Pinterest and all that stuff in my Facebook. And I bought a pair of socks on Fab. And the brand was called...
By the way, those socks were awesome.
They were amazing. I think I'm wearing them right now. The brand was called Let's Have Socks. And apparently popped up in my Facebook stream.
Are you sure those were socks?
I had no idea that this was even going to happen. I opted into this Fab sharing some time ago because they gave me a $10 credit. Like, here's $10 to spend however way you choose. I think I spent it on the socks. And then I opted into this. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing a comment from somebody saying, LOL, that's hilarious. What's hilarious? And it, sure enough, it says, Matt bought Let's Have Socks. And it's like... It was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction for me to then turn off that feature, because I think there's some sense of value to it, but it is kind of scary that sometimes we forget.
Yeah, but that was like the best $10 like Fab has spent on customer acquisition.
That's very true. And now I've told all of you about this, so clearly.
Well, and we now all know that we can pay you to have socks.
Yes,
so,
of course.
So let me ask you this. I think sometimes in the privacy debate, what people are really talking about, we've been nibbling around the edges of this, is security. And we were talking prior to getting up here on stage, and you're each seeing some interesting phenomenon around existing social, local, mobile applications. The one we were talking about was Foursquare, in that behavior of some female populations is not to check in, but to check out. And that users are actually tracking apps, if you will, not at the code level, but at the use level. What do you think those behaviors should be telling today's social, local, and mobile application developers?
I think one of the things is we can't codify privacy in such a way that there are just too many options. There was a phenomenal app a couple years ago, BrightKite, that some friends of mine developed, and it was kind of pre-Foursquare, but they had this really super intricate privacy mechanism where you could grant some friends like access to the venue level, some to the neighborhood level, some to the city level. So like if I checked in, a friend might know, oh, I'm in Austin, right, as opposed to the Hilton. And I think that that is really interesting to me that you know, it didn't quite work ultimately because it was just such a confusing thing to have this granular level of detail. I almost feel like privacy is going to get to this point where it's just pure black and white, where we're either private or we're not. There's a friend that told me about his son having these, whenever they would go to parties, these parties would have what they called a dark room, and it would be one room in the house or whatever. They're having the party everywhere else, but this one room was where they drank the booze. And that room was purposefully dark and black because you couldn't take pictures in it. And it's like, that's a hack. That's not in the code. That's not in the app. That's not anything. They're changing their behavior in the real world because it affects their behavior in the virtual world. And I think that's going to continue to happen. But we have to not make it so difficult where those kinds of things can't serendipitously happen. They have to have just some level of malleability for it to work.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're living through kind of what happened in the 90s. I don't know if anybody lived through the 90s, but it was sort of anybody who worked for you or you worked for somebody, they came in and they said, we got to have a website. And raise your hand if in the last 4 years somebody that, you know, you've worked for has said, we got to have an app, right? Yeah, so it's everybody. And so what we found is people built these apps, they went out there, they didn't really know what they were doing it for. And so we're now seeing these sort of second generation of apps where people are saying, okay, wait a minute, how can we take advantage of the inherent nature of these devices that know who we are, know where we are, know what we like, so that you can actually create a conversation over time with these users instead of just trying to create brochureware. I mean, my favorite example was, and they fixed this now, was Toyota. They actually, their first version of their app, you could go in and actually build a Camry. So the first thing I think of when I'm trying to buy a Camry is I'm going to go to the Apple App Store and download an app and then configure this and then request a quote, right? That's not how you want to do that. Instead, and this is what they've done now, is, hey, why not, you know, when you leave the lot with that car and you have a smartphone, put that app in there and take a picture of your, you know, scan your VIN, and now they have a connection to you, right? So they can tell you about important safety recall information, or they can tell you, hey, there's a bay open in the oil change slot, you know, that's just a couple blocks from you. And by the way, we're going to give you a 20% coupon if you come in, you know, an hour from now. So that's where I think we're going to start to see these behaviors changing and the sort of the nature of these apps changing over time.
You know, just to go back to the privacy thing a little bit, I was thinking about, and it's a different point than what you were making, but I'm going to go with it. It occurs to me that privacy is also sort of a negotiated state between an individual and perhaps their peers or people who are also in a similar or shared context. And it's a very hard thing to figure out exactly what everyone's expectations are. It's sort of like a multiplayer game or a first-person shooter in some ways where some guns are off limits and so on. Anyways, just work with it. in other words, like, the rules are sort of unclear. Like, we're still trying to figure out exactly, like, you know, if I had to ask all my friends what their expectations were, and let's say I have 300 friends about me sharing their information, it just would never happen. And if you have to multiply those 300 requests per every application that I use, it also breaks down. So there's a bit of a, you know, common or group identity or group behavior thing that's implicit in these applications that also makes this, I think, extremely challenging. And so it occurs to me that one of the questions that still hasn't been resolved yet is whether or not, you know, we kind of go in the full direction of like data libertarianism and have every individual make every decision for themselves, or whether the service kind of plays God mode and decides what the right defaults are for its members. And there's sort of a tacit understanding between, let's say, downloading one of these apps, let's say Grindr, and using it a certain way, that the other people who are using that service sort of like, I'm okay with the rules that the app maker is using in this venue or in this place, and if I don't want to play that game anymore, I just, you know, opt out, I exit, you know, game over, man, that kind of thing. And I don't know where that goes, but I guess the point is that privacy, can't just be left up to an individual senator who's like freaked out about something. And it also is something that has to be continually revisited and considered, as opposed to sort of set once and then forgotten forever.
Yeah, the reconsidered thing is really important. So there's this funny thing where Netflix right now would love to be able to publish on your Facebook page what movies you've been watching. That seems like a pretty decent thing. I mean,
everyone else is doing it. So.
Yeah, so why not want to do that? Well, it turns out that there's this law from the 80s that was created because somebody wanted to be able to keep track of what movies you rented over time, like a Blockbuster or whatever. And apparently one senator probably didn't want all of the pornos that he had rented to be known, and so created a law that basically said that you couldn't share my or have my history of movies rented. That became law, and now Netflix can't share that activity because that archaic law still exists. And so, you know, we do have to revisit these things. There's a strange laws that exist that somehow existed for some completely different reason some number of years ago, but now with computers and innovation and things like that, they have to be brought back up to the surface, but they're just, it's not happening.
Now, you know, to build on that though, I think one of the things that's interesting and is starting to evolve, I think now that we've got a few big players in this space that are giving you the ability to record lots and lots of stuff about yourself, is the degree to which you can record lots and lots of different like types of information, lots of different activities, and then be able to go back and audit those things and remove the things which you feel are unsavory or you just, you know, don't want people knowing how many cat videos you watch. I think whether it's, you know, Google web search history or YouTube history, the ability to go back and actually edit those things and prune those things, I think, is extremely important. And I think that in the 80s, when this law was originally written, it was not very common practice or even feasible, really, for, I think, an individual to go to Blockbuster and sort of like do a FOIA request and say, oh, you know, what have you got for all my rentals? Remember, people used to like rent physical VHS tapes. What have you got for all my rentals? And can I remove some of them from your list? Because, you know, someday I don't want the government finding out what I've been watching or even my friends, whatever it is that's sort of the embarrassing aspect of that. Now it's becoming at least a little more possible for you as, again, sort of, I guess, putting my data libertarian hat on, for you to go and kind of figure out, like, well, which things am I okay sharing? And now that I do have control over this, how much control do I really want to take? And then you, as an app developer, how much control should you be giving people to audit and, you know, give control to individuals over what's shared over time? You know, are you giving people the ability to forget and forgive, or will everything be recorded forever? And it's basically up to each service to figure that out right now.
So let's shift gears and let's... We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about socially ambient apps. It seems to be the buzz phrase coming in, and there's a lot of debate about the merit of these apps. Talk a little bit about those and what you see the opportunity is there in the future, as well as perhaps what you think some of the pitfalls are immediately. And I know, Matt, you're burning to share one of them because it literally burned out your battery.
Well, you know, yeah. So there's a couple apps that have come out pre-South By that seem to be, you know, making all the news buzz, one of them being Highlight, and I installed this app, and it was pretty. It showed me that there were people nearby, and that was somewhat interesting to me, but it halved my battery life in 3 hours. I went from 100% to 50% in 3 hours, and sometimes, I mean...
And that was background usage, it wasn't active yeah. usage.
I was not correct? Even using the phone, and it just... destroyed the battery, and so
yeah, the GPS radio was fired up. Yeah.
It needs this sort of ambient awareness. We need to have a level of intelligence behind it, because something that just sits in the background and just watches at my every single move and everywhere that I go, that's going. It's not going far, because I think that the purpose of the app is certainly there. It's that the technology is not there yet for us to be able to even do that. And so let's just kind of come up with something a little bit smarter. I love, not to bring up Square again, but I love CardCase. CardCase is this thing where I can turn it on, tell the venues that I want, or the shops that I go to, that I want to open up a tab whenever I walk into that door. And it's extremely useful to me because, at least for the coffee shop that's right around the corner from me in San Francisco, when I walk in the door, my tab is open, and all I have to do is say, hey, put that on Matt. And I'm not touching a thing. I didn't pull out my wallet, didn't pull out my phone, didn't do anything. I just said, put it on Matt. That, to me, that level of ambient awareness is really nice, because it's this level of intelligence. It doesn't kill my battery, and there's just something nice about it and something easy. But it needs to improve my life, not just destroy the battery of the phone that I'm actually trying to use and actually make use of on a daily basis?
Well, so that's obviously a current limitation, and there's lots of businesses that will spring up perhaps to address that issue. One of the things that I'm thinking that's sort of interesting about this opportunity, though, is the degree to which we're, through these different platforms that we're using, whether it's Foursquare or Facebook or Twitter or Google or whatever, the ability to kind of like have APIs, for what it's worth, into your friends' pockets. Because they have these devices, these little computers running constantly, you know, taking in inputs, taking in information, you know, if there were more of a P2P style interaction where I could sort of like ping Matt and sort of have his phone agent in his pocket tell me, yeah, he's available right now, or no, actually he's on the toilet, or whatever, or buying.
I don't want you to know that.
Available.
Or buying socks, whatever, you know, that might be TMI, but regardless, it wouldn't be that cool in that case. But anyways, if you think about that, where for the first time you can actually sort of bother your friends without bothering your friends about what's going on with them, leads to this whole new kind of level of ad hoc collaboration and coordination that previously wasn't really possible. And I think Highlight and Glancy and Sonar and a lot of these other ones are sort of trying to, in words that I've used before, accelerate serendipity and help you find people and interact and engage through some common currency, whether those are interests or people, so you can actually expand the size of your network. Now, I feel a little tapped out in terms of the size of my network, but I still think that there's an interesting opportunity there to engage with people in a way that kind of like is just more late binding. You know, you meet someone, you've got something in common, a few things in common, and immediately you have something more to talk about. And perhaps it's because these apps are being built by introverts that they make a lot of sense. I think people who have active social lives probably don't need these things that much. But being an introvert myself, as you can tell, it sort of makes sense that it's like, oh, hi, awkward silence, let me look at my phone. Oh, you're into this thing, socks. You know, kind of works. I'll say one other random thing, because that's how my brain works. I went to the Apple store in San Francisco, actually, to buy another battery for my phone because of the problem Matt describes. And I don't know if you guys have done this yet, but you can now, like, self-checkout. And it's like, you know, going to the supermarket and, like, self-checking out, and, like, they have those terrible machines. They're, like, built on PCs or something. Anyways, and you can now sort of, like, scan a barcode with your iPhone and pay for it using your Apple ID and walk out, and the security guards don't even look at you. And I'm like, wow, I just, like, shoplifted but paid for it. This is so weird.
You have that stutter step at the door where you're like, can I just walk out right now?
Am I going to be tackled? Like, where's the cameras? Anyways, so if you apply that fluidity of an experience to all sorts of different aspects of your life, whether it's going to the coffee shop, whether it's going to a store and sort of seeing like, okay, here are the things that I need, and they're just brought to you, it does sort of introduce this whole new like leisure time that none of us are going to have any idea what to do with. So we're probably just going to build more brochureware apps. But regardless, I think it's an interesting idea to think about once you actually have sort of a more frictionless commerce experience as opposed to an automated sharing experience.
I think we have to be careful, though, because I think in some instances we're creating solutions to problems that don't exist. Like this whole, that, okay, I hate to rag on Highlight. It's a fine app. They're fine guys. I think that there's a lot of people that are big fans. But for me, I look at this app and I think, there's nothing about this that makes me actively want to talk to the person that it's even showing me. Like, I want to know when my friends are nearby so that I can connect with them a little better. I like that kind of serendipity. But for it to say, hey, you have three friends in common and you like the X-Men, I don't know, whatever it may be, I don't know that that's enough for me to want to actively engage that person that just walked in through the coffee shop door. I feel like that's like one level. It's an app that is telling me to be awkward. It's like, hey, you like X-Men, don't you? Like, I don't feel like that's something that is of human nature at all. I feel like there are other ways that we can engage people. It's like, if you've got a bag of coffee in your hand and that's the same coffee that I like, that's slightly less awkward because there's something physically representing our connection. But I don't think when you have no physical representation of that connection or that icebreaker, if you will, I don't think there's such thing as virtual icebreakers. I really don't. I think that it's human nature to want to find something physical between two people and then be able to interact.
Buy so, socks.
With socks, yes. If I'm we really need to stop.
Sorry. With
socks.
Yeah, it's
it's trending.
Yeah, it's trending right now. Yeah. Their sales have gone up 1,000%. But I really think we have to be careful about this, like just building apps to build apps.
I think what you're talking about, though, is the lack of intent. You know, where perhaps you want to put yourself out there, and you were talking about like how Path kind of has this mode where you can go to sleep or you wake up. And that metaphor, that idea that, you know, when you're asleep, your phone's asleep, and then it wakes up and it's your agent again and it's doing things for you, I think we're not at the point yet where the device sort of either is prompting you about certain opportunities that may exist when you're in the moment to be prompted for those things. It just doesn't know you that well. It's like, you know, you have this sort of like rant, like it learns who you are every time you like turn it on again, as opposed to sort of like getting better over time with every new app that you install. So you're like, for example, every time that I use Yelp or like OpenTable, like all these things, like they always show me like these restaurants that are really good with meat, and I just eat fish and vegetables. It's like, that's kind of like missing the point, and it's a really weird, I feel like I'm like 80 years old and I'm in a very strange like marriage, but they forget who I am all the time and my name and stuff. Anyways, so it's like, when does the device get to the point where it actually sort of like cuts out those opportunities that I think to your point are awkward and presents ones to you that are actually based on like your availability for certain types of new experiences or encounters? And we're just not there yet.
So I think getting back to Jeff's question around, you know, these apps that are out there, I think, you know, sure, the devices have all kinds of limitations. And, you know, I the only thing I want in the next 2 years is a phone that lasts for more than a day without having to charge. Like, I'm jacked in. Like, I feel like I've got a problem. I'm like looking around for power, you know, all over the place.
And where's
like,
your next hit?
How would a person vacuum this area? Because then I can find where the power plug is. Anyways,
this is my battery. I'm carrying this around right. Just so I stay alive.
You should sew that into your shirt.
But, you know, speaking of launching, I think at South by Southwest, a lot of folks talk about, you know, Foursquare and Twitter and how successful they were by launching at, you know, at South by Southwest. And Twitter didn't launch here. They'd been around for 9 months. I mean, it was a side project that was a side project that was a side project. And I actually was sitting at a table with Chris in like 2006. And this is pre-iPhone.
I was like 12.
And we're sitting down. Yeah, you were like 12. And we're sitting down to dinner, and there's like 12 of us. And I sit down, and I'm visiting from out of town, and everybody's heads go down into their phone, and they're texting. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, we're Twittering. And I'm like, what the fuck is a Twitter? Anyways, long story short, that was 9 months before South by Southwest. And so the idea of coming here and, you know, thinking that you're going to launch an app and it's just, you know, everything's going to take off, I think is pretty crazy. And there's been some apps that launched last year that, you know, haven't necessarily done super well. So I think they're interesting. I think they're leading indicators of things to come. I think it's always, you know, fun to think about, you know, South by Southwest is kind of what the future is going to be like. But we're not quite there yet.
I really hope that the future is like barbecue on demand from Uber. Really, as long as I can have that in any city, I'll be very happy. That will be my favorite phone in the world.
So I want to ask, does the future in this space have a problem because most of the apps are being developed by 20-something dudes?
You're talking to a 20-something dude, so I don't know that there's...
And part of the reason is I'm also, you know, a 40-something with two kids, and that changes the dynamic on how I want to be ambient, right?
What do you think?
I have an opinion.
Yeah, start us off here.
Well, I think there's opportunities being missed because there is a bubble effect around San Francisco and some of the development areas. And there's a whole flyover area that some of us live in that could benefit from apps that think a little bit more about how people connect who have jobs that require them to drive and kids who are pulling at them when they're in the Starbucks or the coffee shop and they can't have the nice conversation about the coffee with the pretty lady because they've got a ring on their finger and all that kind of stuff.
You know, I'm not convinced that we need to codify this stuff. Like, I think it's fine that it's the 20-something dude building this stuff. I think it's the same problem as the privacy situation. You build it, and your users are going to take it over and make it for what it is. I mean, does anybody realize in this audience that Pinterest was developed by 20-something dudes? Like, no, it's 90% women that are on that site, and they've completely taken it over, and they've molded it to what it is, and now their entire development cycle is going to be based on that. So I think that you create apps to inspire. You inspire people in a such a way that then allows them to do what they want, and then everything else is kind of driven from there. And I don't think that we need to be thinking too much ahead and, you know, say like, oh, our audience is going to be this so that we need to develop it like this. I think that we just need to solve real problems, and when we solve real problems, then the audience will find it, and then the audience will take it from there and turn it to what it needs to be.
I
like that answer.
No. I completely disagree. I mean, coming I mean, I hate to say this. I mean, I'm a privileged white guy. And so my concerns and the things that I worry about are very different than a lot of other people. And I can't say that I fully intuit or understand everyone else's experience in the world, but I know that it's not exactly like mine. And so when I bring my assumptions or my experiences into applications, or when I publish a lot of things that I do on the web, I know that a lot of other people don't necessarily have the same privilege to do the same thing because their fears are very different than mine. And there's some expectation that I will use applications in this way, that I will publish these things, and I won't worry about my boss, you know, Vic Indotra, sort of coming down on me and saying, dude, like, you know, why were you at this thing at this hour last night doing this thing when you should have been doing this other thing? And so I think that there is a whole slew of applications that are waiting to be built that actually have a better understanding of all the different types of experiences that people have in the world. And I think this is one of the things, you know, whether it's Path or whether it's lots of other applications that make assumptions about who's in your address book. I mean, let's be honest. Actually, let's not be honest. I don't know how many of you are drug dealers, but if I were using some of these applications, I would think very differently about them sending my contact list to the cloud, you know? So, not that I know what that experience is like, but you get my point, right? So I just think that we have to be very, very careful about bringing the assumptions that we have to the applications that we build and be very humble about how much we actually understand the experience of other people, and constantly, I guess, be open to and willing to ask the questions about, well, is the way that I'm thinking about this really the way that people are thinking about this out there? And what do they have as expectations and norms that should inform the way that this app develops?
So I want to finish up with one question, and then we are going to have our local mic here and our mobile mic I will go out with. Scott, I want to throw this to you. Yeah. What's the future of messaging around these apps to ensure that users are actually engaged? Because, you know, obviously users are downloading tons of apps, you know, hundreds of thousands more are coming. You've got to keep those folks engaged and educate them about how your application is evolving to suit their needs. They aren't logging into it, that's a problem. Is that area going to evolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think messaging is at the core of, you know, successful app strategies. You do want to create a conversation, but not every app, you know, will need messaging. And I think that's an important part. I mean, that's really it. I mean, messaging is such a critical thing. And for the last, you know, whatever, 20 years, messaging on mobile has been through SMS, and the carriers have had effectively a 100% margin business. And people have to think, well, geez, it's going to cost me 3 cents to send this message to this user. I better make sure that the ROI on it is really high, where instead the user might want to receive lots of notifications. You know, ESPN is one of our customers, and we actually power, you know, sports scores for them. Sports fans, there's no such thing as too many notifications for them. Literally, you can send 150 in a day, and it's not enough. And that's, you know, that's fine. That's what they've opted in for, and I think that's super, super powerful. But you know, there's with great power comes great responsibility. There are folks who send too many notifications saying like, hey, you haven't even opened our app. Like, that's kind of the worst thing that you could ever do. So don't do that.
I also hate the your friend installed this app. Can we just please stop that? Everybody in the room that builds apps, never do that again. It really makes us angry.
Yeah, there's a bunch of those. Your virtual pet is about to die. Those, you know, that's the other. Yeah.
All right. Extrovert mic, local mic, mobile mic, introvert mic. All right, right here.
Hi. I was thinking while you were talking that it seems like in the device environments, we've kind of closed, I think, a lot of the new devices and a lot of the touch technology that you were talking about and your personal feelings about that have closed the age gap in terms of technology, but the app side of things is widening the age gap because of privacy, because of concerns of people who have kids, because of things like that. And I feel like there's a real tension in that space now. It's like my mom loves her iPad, but she wouldn't use 3/4 of the apps I use because they scare the crap out of her, right? So how do we think more about that when a lot of the apps are being built by 20-something white dudes?
All right, so I think that there's some interesting, I don't know if they're patterns yet, but maybe ways of thinking about it, which actually sort of brings us back to where applications, well, so I worked on a campaign to launch Firefox called Spread Firefox, and the way that that worked, and I think the way that Firefox got a lot of its initial sort of early adopters and then subsequent adopters, was that you had someone who sort of knew something about an application, got the gestalt of like what was interesting about it, and then installed it on their parents' computer or their sister's computer or their grandparents' computer or whatever it was. And even though, you know, that audience maybe didn't quite exactly understand what was interesting about it, there was that kind of social proof delivered through that relationship. And so whenever they used that application again, there was sort of a reminder of that person that had installed it for them. So in some ways, I think thinking about how these applications spread through or are, let's say, designed around social computing experiences, especially with tablet devices, they're a very social, very kind of group-oriented device. Thinking about how you can design for the in-person IRL experience is something that a lot of apps don't do yet. They sort of presume sort of single-player mode and everyone's got something in their pocket. But if you design for that multiplayer mode, you might actually get other ways of having people tell the story of your application in a way that's meaningful to the person who's presenting it to the other person, in a way that resonates more than just kind of trying to, you know, hey, go download this app. It'll be awesome. It'll change your life. And then they get lots of push notifications for why aren't they using the app. Anyways.
All right, we have a question over here, and I think you guys might have to incentivize because that is the local. So maybe like $10 will get somebody up to that microphone.
Yeah, just line up. I mean, we're happy
poncho.
To see you right there.
Range That's poncho.
Just uncomfortably close. My name is Jason Dipperstein. I work for Aetna Insurance, and my question is for Matt. So with your SOX story, my question is, in terms of fault, how much of the company's fault is it for not presenting terms and conditions in a way that you could understand? How much of it is your fault for reading the terms and conditions, you know, glossing them over, signing it, and then passing on and moving to something else? And how do we bridge that gap and make sure that the experience isn't broken so that the average user understands where they're supposed to be and how that security and how that privacy is impacted by all of the experiences that they have?
The terms thing is a tough one. There was a funny experiment, social experiment, that a game developer did some number of years ago where they put at the very, or somewhere in the terms and conditions, if you see this, contact us and we will give you $10,000. And it literally took, I think it took them like 8-9 months for one person to even respond to that. So clearly we don't read terms of service. And it's getting worse. If you pull up the terms of service for your phone, like whenever it comes up, Apple, whatever, has changed their terms of service. 42 pages on this thing. It's not going to happen. It's just simply not going to happen. So I think that to some extent it's the company's responsibility to dumb those down a little bit. Just like, here are the 10 things you really need to know, right?
Or a diff.
Or a diff. Just something that can at least explain this a little bit better than has been explained before. But I also think it's the responsibility of the user to not be a complete idiot. And I say that in a rather mean way, but the path thing just blew my mind because it's like all the people that were freaking out about a social app asking or like taking my thing to be social. Like it's like, okay, the whole purpose of the app was that it knew who my friends were. And it needed my contact book to do that. And so how does it become social without that? You know, so I think that to some extent we just have to be a little bit smarter and just like, maybe it's reading between the lines, I don't know, maybe I'm going a little bit too far with that, but I do think that it's a shared responsibility between the user and the company. I think the companies need to be a little bit smarter about how they present terms of service. I think the legalese needs to be there, but I think that we do need to have some new way of explaining to users what the rules are. But I also think that users need to wisen up a little bit and just try and be a little bit educated about the things that they're giving away whenever they do these things.
Well, I mean, it's also just about context. And I think presenting the relevant information at the right moment and making sure that you're not helping users to embarrass themselves. I mean, in the case of Matt, I mean, he did sort of authorize his application to do exactly what it said it was going to do, and then it actually did what it said it was going to do. And then he had like a...
You're using my example against me.
A lol social experience. And I don't actually think it was that bad. Now, it could have been bad, but part of it is also helping people, again, I think, to have confidence about using your app. And from a brand perspective, you know, don't fuck your users. Like, I guess Google says, like, don't you know, focus on the user and all as follows. But it's another shorthand, I guess.
It could have been a lot worse, actually. I know that they had, you know, they're like candy necklaces. Fab was selling candy underwear for a while there. Like, it was, like, made out of candy necklaces. So that could have been a lot worse. Glad I didn't purchase that.
All right, we have our first local question.
Yes.
So thank you, panel, for your thoughts on privacy.
There you go.
What do you think about ownership of that data? So as data becomes more public, who owns the data? Does Facebook own my data? Or can I say, I don't care, just whoever wants to read my Twitter feed, they can read it today. I want them to be able to do the same for Facebook. How does that get resolved, and where do you see the trend going for that? And thanks for not biting.
So I think this is actually one of the most important questions that people have to sort of deal with, at least now in the immediate term, but also long term. And essentially, I've called it this in the past, but I think of this notion of data capital as the stuff that you're creating or generating, whether you're doing it on your own or in coordination with other people. This data is actually extremely valuable, and you should think about like where you put it and what protections you have on it and your ability to go in and actually essentially like sequester this data over time, because the more that you do sequester, the more that it will become more valuable in the long term. At least that's my opinion. And it doesn't necessarily have to be public to gain value. It can be private, just like you pump money in the bank and you gain interest. And picking your sort of cloud agent is going to be one of the key questions that's going to emerge over the next several years. So the key players right now really are coming down to, I think, whether it's Facebook, Google, Dropbox is sort of in there. Microsoft has a bunch of their own solutions. And Apple with iCloud, I think, is a big part of it. And you unlock that data and you access that data through the accounts that you have with them. So your Apple ID is becoming increasingly valuable because it's what's used to synchronize all of your devices. And, you know, as I suggested earlier, it's the same thing that you use to pay for things, at least in Apple stores. So Apple is helping you to basically sequester a lot of this information, a lot of your data, a lot of your contacts, your docs, all these things in the Apple cloud. And I think increasingly there's going to be more and more competition over who provides that service for you. So you'll use lots and lots of different apps, you know, throughout the day. You'll use apps that do care about the data that don't. Some will provide you with ways of sending some of that information to different clouds or different data sources and providers. It's still being worked out, but I think you need to think about how there's going to be a major battle, the defining battle, I think, over the next couple of years as to where your data lives, how much you can access it, and what you can do with it, and how much you're paying to keep someone storing it for you. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I'm thinking about it.
All right, question over here.
Hi, we use maps and technology in a nonprofit so that volunteers can locate resources to help their constituents. And one of the things we want to do is have that stuff be more local to them, and then provide feedback. What do you see in the future for that to happen automatically and for the systems to build as they continue to use them?
One of the really interesting apps we saw in the last election cycle, and we'll see it again this time, the DNC put out their app and the Obama for America back in, I guess it was 2008 now. But it was amazing what they could do with you know, having these apps on users' phones and being able to get the vote out. But more importantly, you know, you can do that on a sort of national level, but then you give tools to the local level to be able to say, hey, here's the races that are important in your district or in your neighborhood. Or even more than that, you can. They had one weekend where they did a canvassing campaign, and they sent out a notification to people. They'd open their app. You could pick a neighborhood or a street that you said you would go canvass. And then once you canvassed it, you'd say, yep, I went and canvassed this. And then that way they were able to mobilize a pretty unbelievable amount of users really, really quickly. And to me, that is, you know, that is this collision of you know, solo-mo straight to a device and getting, you know, getting people active. And I think that's, we're going to see a lot more of that to come.
Yeah, I mean, another way to think about it too, and I think, you know, Scott and I have worked a lot on open standards in the past. One of the things that's sort of lacking from this current generation, which I think is perfectly fine because it's, you know, a very innovative kind of free-for-all moment in technology development, you know, is thinking about how, if you're a data provider or a resource provider, or you aggregate these resources, how you make them available either in an ambient way where they can sort of be discovered and sort of brought in at the moment where they're most necessary, or working with sort of the solo-mo app providers to get your data into their systems via APIs. So if you look at like what Foursquare is doing by bringing menus in, or their whole deal with like Amex and stuff like that, I mean, you want to be thinking about what's the last sort of late binding approach that you can take to integrating with the next great solo-mo app that comes out. So it's not about just integrating with like today's apps that happen to be popular. It's about reformulating your entire organization and enterprise around making your resources available at the moment they're needed in whatever application your customers may demand. So it's really rethinking the architecture of how you produce, store, and, you know, activate the information or resources that you're creating.
Hi.
Nice to see you. So going back to the idea of the value of...
Can you speak?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Back to the idea of the value of your data that you're surrendering, essentially, when you use different apps. I think one of the challenges is that all these apps are free, right? And so when you use a free service, users might have the idea that somehow you're making money off of them. Otherwise, why the investment in making the app? You know, what is your business model? So to what degree, I mean, could you charge a fee for apps more or somehow monetize it? And maybe that gives users the impression that you're not selling their data in alternative ways. I mean, what's the kind of the business model around this changing value of data and how privacy is protected?
So I see user data as currency. And it can be any user data. It can be my demographics, it can be my location, it can be anything. And I think that it needs to be used responsibly. Like, that currency is provided to me. So, like, the fact that you're standing or in a Hilton right now, or you're sitting in a Hilton right now, that is currency to me. You can give me that information, whether that be Foursquare or some other check-in app, and I can use that to do something, provide you with an advertisement, explain to the Hilton how many, you know, 20-somethings are going through their doors, you know, anything like that. And you have to users have to understand, and they don't just yet, which is that if I'm not buying something, if I'm not paying you for this product, I am now the product,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And that's something that doesn't really resonate with people. Like, they just expect, oh, you know, this the news thing, now that I'm in the news world, this is the most interesting to me, because it used to be that I pay for a newspaper, right? It is giving me value. And now people just expect news to be given to them for free, which is interesting. But all these other apps, you know, that I'm getting something for free. There are some places you will always find that that little bit of money being created. Pinterest is a great example where I'm pinning the things that I'm interested in purchasing, or, you know, that I think are neat designs and things like that. And I love this post recently where people were freaking out that they were making money off of affiliate links. It's like, yeah, okay, what did you expect them to do? Of course they're going to append that little bit of something at the end of the URL so that they can make some money off of you using this free service. So I think that we're just going to continue to see more of these things and more creative ways that money can be made. But I think that it does need to be done responsibly. That's one thing that is really important. As an app maker, as somebody that's going to be building these businesses, we have to understand that this currency is of value to people, right? My giving you my location does have value to me because it's now depleting my privacy, depleting my ability to be completely private. And so I'm giving you this currency and you should be responsible for that. So I think that there's a shared interest when it comes to needing to be, well, responsible around what I'm giving up and what the app is using from me.
Well, but I think in some ways what you're talking about, though, is a type of arbitrage where the app maker, of course, is benefiting from you sharing some of your data capital with them, but it's a lease basis. The moment that you stop using that application or the moment that you disconnect Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is the moment that that app, that you are no longer valuable to the app maker because they're no longer providing you with an equitable exchange. So, you know, just like I talked about one type of privilege before, there will eventually be a class of data privileged people that have lots of information about themselves, that have lots of information about their preferences, that have all sorts of structured data about their interests, and they will be willing to exchange that information for discounts or for a better experience or for a lower rate or for other types of features that are not available to people who are not gathering or collecting this information about themselves. And I think that's one of the things that we need to be thinking about, that we're actually leasing our data out and our ongoing update of that information and keeping that data current by constantly using applications. The moment that we stop using an application, the half-life of the value of our data goes down precipitously because it's no longer available in an up-to-date sort of real-time way. So I think there is actually a little bit more nuance there, again, being able to arbitrage like what your data is worth today versus what will be worth tomorrow if you continue to connect and maintain those connections to those applications.
Question here.
Hi, my name's Josh. I'm here from the UK. Couple of observations. In the UK, the Pinterest demographic is 54% male, so it's very different. But my question really is around the difference between the UK and the US is we have a really skeptical audience. And this, what this means in terms of apps is that it's very difficult, essentially, to get apps which use our data, in particular location data, essentially to get people to even use it. Because people are just naturally skeptical. Even apps I've made, my friends are like, I'm not giving you my data, just for no apparent reason. So I was wondering, I guess the question is, how can we overcome that challenge so that I guess we in the UK can kind of try and get more adoption of location-based services, which I think really provide a lot of benefits, even if it is our data which is then sold on, if you like.
I think part of it's messaging, but I'll share a quick example. Whenever I was doing Simple Geo, I would give this talk to try to explain what it was that we do and the value that we provide and things like that, and I would present in various different fashions. But one of the questions that I would say is, how many people checked in here today? Right? And you guys can raise your hands. How many people checked in here when they walked into this room? Okay, great. So tons of... This was the typical response. So, you know, 75% of all the people in the audience would raise their hand. I did one talk at the Dublin Web Summit, and it was a room of 200 people or whatever, and I'm the sole speaker, and I'm asking this question, all right, how many people checked in today? No one. Literally not a single person in the audience. And this was a year and a half ago. So it was like clearly like Foursquare had taken, you know, had gotten somewhere by then. And I would have expected at least 50% of the room, but nobody. So I agree with your sentiment that it just seems like maybe the value isn't understood, or just the idea that I would even share my location is just so foreign that they wouldn't want to do it. But I think that part of it is just it's taking ourselves a step beyond location as the product to become location as a benefit, right? So with Foursquare, for instance, when Foursquare launched, it was dead simple. It was me saying where I'm at so my friends can know. That's what it was, right? Now Foursquare is a much more complicated beast, but something that people can understand a little bit better, because if I'm checking in, I'm giving it this idea of the kinds of things that I like to go to, the kinds of people I hang out with, things like that. Now when I go to Foursquare, it's a much more... instead of me telling Foursquare what I'm doing, Foursquare is now telling me what I should be doing. And that to me is the exchange that is important for anybody in, you know, the UK, Ireland, things like that. It needs to be providing me actual real value, right? We're weird here. I think that we're okay with just like, you know, throwing out a bunch of content and not caring about the consequences. But I think that as long as something is actually providing real value, I think you'll actually see a step up. You know, you do have to communicate to the user that I'm sharing my location and things like that. But as long as it's actually providing real value, I think that there's a future for location in Europe and locales like that. Does that make sense? Okay.
We have time for one final question.
Hi. I think the sticking point for me when it comes to sharing my data is the security of the data when it's released. So the path situation, I think I it didn't bother me that my data was taken, my address book data was taken. What worries me is my address book was taken, and all of a sudden there's a huge responsibility for that address book data to stay safe. And so often you hear now of breaches of data, and people are going, oh, well, I'm a new company, and, you know, I'm sorry, we'll try better next time. But I'm not sure whether a lot of these companies are taking the security of the data quite serious, you know, enough to, you know, warrant me giving up my data in the first place. I don't know how you feel.
The short of it is that no, people aren't taking it very seriously, and that's really scary. I mean, it's a slightly different example, but when Amazon Web Services went down last year, the East Coast went down. Simple Geo, we spent all this time thinking about failure as a first-class citizen. We recognize that failure happens, and we have to be prepared to fail. And a lot of companies weren't ready for that, and we were one of two. It was us and Netflix that stayed up through the downtime. And using that as an example, people don't take responsibility for the fact, you know, they ask for forgiveness. They say, oh, well, you know, we're on the internet. Things go down, you know, but it's not an excuse anymore. And I think that data security is an interesting one, because there's so many different touch points in which something can fail. And the worst of which is actually a disgruntled employee. That's like... That is a really interesting thing to think about, and not a lot of people think about. We think about all these ways to codify how we protect ourselves from the outside, but, you know, a big one is how we protect ourselves from the inside. Because somebody with a little bit of a reason for not being happy with their employer can do some damage. I don't have a solution other than it needs to be known more that we need to take this stuff a whole lot more seriously than we do.
Well, I mean, at the same time, I just don't think that, like, consumers have the language for it yet. I mean, we can ask companies, you know, like, whether or not food is organic, or we can ask, you know, where the chickens were raised and what their names were and things like that, and that sort of, like, makes some sense. But we can't quite do the same thing for like, well, where do you, how's your data, and what's the name of the servers, you know, and what kind of encryption are you using, and are you using salt and hashes in the right way, or is there pepper in there too, or, you know, like, people just don't know which words to use. So until that articulation sort of makes its way, I think, into like the public consciousness, ideally not through like a senator sort of legislating out of his, you know, belt or whatever.
It's a series of tubes.
It's a series of tubes. You know, I think this problem is going to persist. So the question is, how many times do we get burned until we like need a new hand, or do we actually sort of like solve the problem and figure out how to like ask these questions of the companies that we're using? And again, it goes back to like the brand thing. And if you're a company that's actually working with user data, what promise are you making to them when you take their data and store it on your servers? And what would happen if something went wrong? And think about the damage that can be done to you as well. So I think there's actually more of a symbiotic sort of reality there, and startups who are moving fast just need to keep that in mind, that the damage that can be done through one of these breaches is much greater than the amount of time or the cost that it would take for you to actually do the right thing in terms of protecting that data.
We've hit half past, so we're going to wrap. If you've got the South by Southwest app, we ask that you review the session, provide some feedback, and please join me in thanking our panelists today.